Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David. Glad to be with you.
Well, the November 8th election is being described, the results are being described in very apocalyptic terms. There's a lot of anxiety, angst, fear in the country about what's going to happen in the next couple of months. What was your take on not just the results, but also the whole issue of the Electoral College and the popular vote?
Well, the results are tectonic. I mean, it was a shock for millions that Donald Trump, who ran a campaign of dog whistle racism, misogyny, anger, and also pretty tough class politics, that he won. And I think it was an epic fail for the media. I think it was an epic fail for many institutions in this country. The first struggle, it seems to me, is to stand with those who are in the frontline communities who really may suffer, are in grave danger, immigrants, Muslims, LGBTQ communities, women, Native American communities. If you believe personnel is policy, we're witnessing some pretty frightening appointments. Senator Sessions for Attorney General, he was rejected in 1986. He was so extreme in a Reagan era. General Mattis, who was the butcher of Fallujah. And then, you know, there are others. There are a whole set of crony capitalists. But we have to face up to the fact that this election was not just about misogyny and race. It was also about class. And the nation endorsed Bernie Sanders. And I think Bernie Sanders showed what a powerful fusion class politics can mean in this country, especially at this time. People want people to stand with them. Workers want people to stand with them. Listen, our system is busted. It's broken. We got, you know, is this the, you know, second time in five elections? You got a candidate who won the popular vote who's going to be denied because of the Electoral College. The hope is that this national popular vote movement gains strength, and your listeners should check it out. But the fact is states can make an interstate compact if you get enough states. So we could have a real popular vote in a country. The Electoral College is another arcane institution left over from a different time, anachronistic. But our system is broken. And you saw it, you know, you can say that, yes, Hillary Clinton raised more money or spent more money than Donald Trump, but the pollution of money down ballot in the Senate and other races, the Electoral College, the vote suppression, which is just going to gain speed. Donald Trump is apparently committed to it. If you read his tweets, he's lying about how Hillary Clinton won with illegal votes. So you got a whole set of problems in our electoral system. I will end with one bright note, though. I've always believed that until we have a different electoral system nationally, third parties are very tough to run in a real way in this country. But Maine passed a ranked choice voting initiative, and that could mean proportional representation. And I think that could build out across this country.
Were you sympathetic to the Jill Stein campaign at all?
Again, I'm sympathetic. You know, I was the nation in 1932 endorsed Norman Thomas, the socialist candidate who ran six times for president. When he was asked at the end of his life by Ralph Nader, what was he most proud of? Norman Thomas said, driving my ideas into the Democratic Party. So I believe that until we reform our electoral system, work needs to go into structural reforms that will allow this country to have successful third parties. Until that time, I think what Bernie Sanders did, deciding to run inside the Democratic Party, it was a tough choice for him, was the way to go because he was able to drive issues that had been off the radar of a more corporate Democratic Party, off the radar for too long, and he was able to bust open what I sometimes think of as the policing of the parameters of our politics. So millions of people heard ideas that they'd been denied because our mainstream corporate media system just thought they were fringe, and they tried to treat Bernie Sanders as fringe or marginal, but the gatekeepers weren't suppressing. And so you had, I think, a very important election where Jill Stein, on certain issues, moved beyond Bernie. I will say that. I think the election was still devoid of a truly left progressive foreign policy discussion. Fitfully it came up, but not. But I still think Bernie Sanders ran a kind of third party campaign, if you believe issues and ideas play a role in that inside the Democratic Party. And that ascendancy, that fight, that reckoning inside the Democratic Party that Bernie Sanders and his supporters and the movements around forced in this election must continue in this post-election moment.
Would you favor the elimination of so-called superdelegates, which gave Hillary Clinton an insurmountable lead?
I would. I think they reek of anti-democratic politics. There is a history to them. I think they were formed at a different time in the Democratic Party's history. You know, I know Danny Kanner of the Working Families Party, who can make a case for retaining some of them. But I think better not. I think it's not only substance but optics that, again, if you are a small D Democrat, you opt for eliminating superdelegates.
Now, Sanders made that choice of running as a Democrat, yet you had this ironic situation where the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, went to work against Sanders and was quite negative.
You know, I think you had that exposed with the WikiLeaks, but I think what we need to do now is there's a fight on, right, for the chair of the DNC. It's a little bit insiderish, but you got someone like Keith Ellison, who is one of very few, I think three or four people in the Congress who endorse Bernie Sanders. He took on Paul Wellstone's seat in Minnesota. He is a believer in grassroots politics. Grassroots movements need to be part of any vibrant party. Mm-hmm. There are others who are running. So I think we need to pay attention to the DNC so that it plays a different role. I'm not saying, all Democratic Party all the time. I think there need to be nonpartisan races and third parties around the country, which can be successful. But take back, hijack the DNC. As, by the way, some people are taking back state Democratic parties. Jane Klebe in Nebraska, very interesting environmentalist, who forged a coalition between farmers and environmentalists to stop the pipeline there. She was a Sanders delegate. She's taken over the local party. It's something, years ago Michael Moore used to talk about. I think that's promising, as I think small D Democrats need to think hard now about going back to cities, states, localities, because the national is going to be so tough for all kinds of things.
And given no doubt that Trump will be appointing Supreme Court justices, a central issue remains Citizens United, and chances of rolling that back will, of course, recede.
Well, I do think small D Democrats, progressives, need to think hard about where they're going to pitch and wage their battles. I think everything can't be a five-alarm outrage, but I do think opposing Sessions for Attorney General and on the court, coming up with creative ideas to put sand in the wheels is going to be important. But again, on the states, my colleague John Nichols, who writes a lot about this, I'm not going to give you the right number, but there are 19 states and 60 cities. I mean, there's a wonderful populist wildfire wave against Citizens United passing in cities and states. And I think we're going to need to build that kind of politics from the grassroots, from the localities up. The court seems, that's receding now. You're right. I mean, this election, I often marvel that progressives don't pay enough attention to the court. And if this was an election to pay attention to the Supreme Court, I mean, if not now, when? I think the right understands the power of the courts to shape our lives, from consumer rights, workers' rights, to reproductive rights, race rights, or civil rights. But I think we need to go back to the states and try and win some of these battles in localities.
It seems that no matter what outrage Trump committed, that he became like a Teflon candidate.
Titanium.
Yeah,
Teflon is not, he's of a 21st century model. Okay. Reagan was Teflon, okay. Right? This guy.
Nothing stuck to him.
I don't think that's true, David. I do think, and I wrote a few columns about this, that we saw media malpractice in this election. I'm thinking of the corporate media primarily, cable TV, the unfiltered, obscene, excessive coverage of Trump abetted his rise, didn't create him. And then the failure to hold him accountable, to treat him as a reality star. And then, this is an issue you've covered for years. The conglomeratization of media, where news is a cog in these conglomerates, leads them to clickbait, to entertainment, to revenues above public interest. And that obliteration of the line between news and entertainment is a frightening development. But I think you know, we had correspondents in Ohio when the tax return story moved, that you could see polls, you could see people paying attention to that. You could see people paying attention to stories of his self-dealing, his foundation, his for-profit university, how he badly treated his workers, the outsourcing of Trump products. But you're right that, you know, this Tyndall report, this media monitoring group, put out something a few weeks ago saying that the nightly news networks, the three of them, covered some 32 minutes on issues, and they had a way of defining issues total in 2016. So it became a race about character and flash, and the Clinton campaign sadly did too much of that too. I mean, instead of really driving, I would argue, economic issues, how Clinton stands with you. I mean, she was moved by Bernie Sanders' platform. You got a lot of how Trump, and he was a predator, and he was boorish, and you didn't want his finger on the nuclear button. But that, in the end, didn't work for a lot of communities in this country, which are ravaged, where people want to feel that they're being listened to and being heard. And I think, by the way, the elite media, in the end, became an anti-Trump echo chamber to the point that there was a backlash against that. Instead of really doing issues, it just became also, in its own way, how dangerous and unfit he was, which he is, but you need to do the issues, too.
And speaking of the elite media, we're in New York. The New York Times has been using very judgmental adjectives now in its lead stories, calling what Trump was saying baseless, there's no evidence for it, false, those kinds of, it's an interesting lexical progression.
It is. You know, the term, by the way, the term post-truth was coined in the pages of The Nation in 1992 by the playwright Stephen Tessich. Remember, he did Breaking Away, that film about Bloomington, but put that aside because there, you know, I've always believed, and I know you've interviewed far wiser people on the media, Noam Chomsky, but there's a myth of objectivity. These elite media have not been objective, you know, and I think that there's more honesty. At The Nation, we're honest about our values, where we come from. We're rigorous about facts and evidence and fact-checking. But, you know, I think The Times is been moved to this by Trump. May it find its way to think hard about access journalism. You know, there are a whole slew of journalistic issues, which I think this election, which was kind of a rewrite the election, has upended the rules leading media institutions to think hard. But I was struck today, I read the lead editorial about General Mattis, who's been appointed defense secretary. I mean, if you know, if you provide the context and know the history, this guy was the butcher of Fallujah. This guy is on the board of the snake oil drug testing company, Theranos. He was on the board of General Dynamics. There's not a word in the New York Times lead editorial except that he's a responsible pick because he's part of the foreign policy establishment. So you're seeing a tension here, right? I mean, they're ready to castigate Trump because he's not playing by their rules, but they're still buying into normalizing what needs to be scrutinized, as someone said.
America's role in the world, so-called.
America's role in the world, America's, you know, policing of the world, America's depredations in the world. But at least give us some facts, because this editorial was very, like, this general has experienced. Well, I have to say, we saw that, I would argue, the Bernie-Hillary Clinton primary, he said a few times something which is real, which is experience isn't necessarily judgment. I mean, you can have experience running counterinsurgency programs or being the architect of a failed war, but that's not judgment, and I think that needs to be hashed out.
Right. Or a hitman for the mafia.
Or a hitman for the mafia.
I think his moniker, Mattis's moniker, is Mad Dog.
Mad Dog or Warrior Monk. No, but it's just basic reporting, and I do worry that, you know, people who say, well, it doesn't matter because Trump is Teflon or titanium, people aren't listening. I still think journalists need to do that accountability watchdog role. And it may take time to, you know, deepen, but it will lead to change. And, you know, it's not just electoral politics. I mean, we did a series on the abuses in private prisons, and the Department of Justice in this summer imposed a moratorium on federal use of private prisons. Now, watch the contract and bidding on private prisons now, so we need to go back into that work because, you know, independent media is also a check, as other branches could be checks on unwieldy power.
Do you think some people invest too much in elections and their outcomes and get emotionally attached? Oh, my candidate lost, the end is near, I just feel so depressed.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, first of all, casting your ballot is only one part of being part of a democratic process. I think people need to be in motion every day of the year. I think what's exciting, and now it's going to be complicated, but a few months ago, in this past couple of years, it's been a movement moment. We've seen movements arise, powerful movements, which have brought 15 minimum wage. Black Lives Matter has brought more surveillance of out-of-control policing, immigrant rights, environmental. We've seen divest and I mean, there are all kinds of movements in motion. And so that fusion between electoral and movement is vital, it seems to me. Great change in this country comes about from movements in the streets, but also finding allies in the electoral process. I remember Obama and Clinton in 2008 had what seemed to me a futile debate about, was it Johnson or King who passed the Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act? I mean, it took the civil rights movement and its moral power, but it took a Johnson to drive that legislation, which now is under assault. So, you know, the history of America and the history of freedom is unending struggle to maintain, to hold, to advance.
Very much.
And by the way, presidential elections, I think, are overrated, too. I mean, they are because of the court, obviously, control of the federal apparatus. But we get way president-centric and lose sight, I think, of other pieces of that electoral puzzle.
Those movements from below, of course, is a major theme of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, for example. It's pointed out that King never held elective office. Right. Mahatma Gandhi never held elective office. Nevertheless, they were able to drive huge movements.
Well, the nation was founded by abolitionists in 1865. Talk about movements. Our cover story this week is Bill McKibben on the power of the few versus the power of the many versus the ruthless few. And it's really an ode to the power of nonviolent direct action in these times and other times. And he talks about Gandhi. It was in honor of Jonathan Schell, who was a great contributor to The Nation for many years. It was a lecture series launched in his honor. But he wrote a book called The Unconquerable Few, and in it he was the one, by the way, you know, we talk about how we lost the fight to oppose the Iraq War, but there were millions of people around the globe. We were the other superpower for that period, and I think we need to understand our victories and not simply revel in our defeat, because you need both to move forward, to keep people engaged.
Jonathan Schell, incidentally, a childhood friend of mine.
Is that right?
We grew up on East 87th Street.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I got to know him very well. Really miss him.
A dear man, yes, and a great writer.
Yeah.
Well, just to go back to electoral politics, I mean, what do you see happening in 2018 in terms of organizing and getting more like-minded liberal progressive voices?
So there are various projects underway. I mean, one project comes out of the Sanders campaign, Our Revolution. And I was talking to someone in Wisconsin yesterday who's probably going to set up the Wisconsin chapter of Our Revolution. And the hope is to have many, many states participating and running people in local offices. We've talked about this project for a long time. I always hate to say that the right kind of got it better, but you got to do school boards and you got to do city councils and municipalities. So I think there'll be a lot of energy put into that. There's a network of people, again, movement fused with electoral, Working Families Party now, not just in New York State, but in 13 or 14 states, People's Action, 350.org, Demos. These groups are meeting to try and recruit people to run issue initiatives. And 2018 is going to be tough, less so maybe to take back some governorships. But the Senate seats, sadly, unlike this year when we lost, are in much tougher states. But I think, you know, to run city council, to run school board, to run those races, and I would say in Congress, it's going to be tough. But one thought I had is, we've written about this, is you drive sort of progressive, emblematic issues, message, ideas at the state and local level, city level. 15 minimum wage, paid sick leave, issues that improve the condition of people's lives and make sure that there's a, in the Senate and Congress, you have people lifting those ideas up and connecting to the grassroots. The Progressive Caucus, for example, has about 80 members. These are good people. These are people who go stand with movements, stand with striking workers, stand with Black Lives Matter activists. And the Senate, you have, you would have had a real Progressive Caucus for the first time. Senator Merkley was ready to coordinate it. So I think that needs to go on. I learned the other day, you may know this, that the Commerce Department runs the census. There's a lot of stuff we need to look at where real damage could be done, you know, like abolishing the Bureau of Labor Statistics, defunding the compiling of labor stats, or how will the census, which is going to gear up next year, be run under possibly a Wilbur Ross, Trump's appointee for commerce. So these are things I think where journalism and other activists need to pay attention.
Wilbur Ross, a billionaire in his own right.
Wilbur Ross, you know, a pretty, I mean, these guys like Wilbur Ross and Steve Mnuchin, who will likely be at Treasury, you know, they are the foreclosure pimps. I mean, they made an enormous amount of money off of the pain of people in the foreclosure crisis and in shutting down community industries. So, yeah, it's a, for all the talk of, you know, Trump, we need to expose hypocrisy, too. If you remember some of the rallies, Trump talked about Goldman as the great evil, Goldman Sachs. I think he's got four or five Goldman alum already lined up and many more to come. So as someone said, it's not draining the swamp, it's filling it with alligators, not to be mean to alligators.
Eduardo Galeano, the great Uruguayan writer and historian, his Open Veins of Latin America is a very important book. He was asked, you know, how do you keep your spirits going? And he says, you know, I'll save despair for better times.
Yes. Well, I was reading this afternoon someone I value and have loved over the years, no longer with us, Studs Terkel. Studs Terkel, who said action engenders hope. And not a false optimism, but to be hopeful, you have to be in motion, you have to be engaged, you have to work with others. And I value that. I will say, you know, the morning after we all traipsed into the nation offices, the morning after the election, down ballot and all, and, you know, people were mourning, some people were weeping. There was a younger generation at a editorial meeting who've lived through Obama. They've never lived through Reagan, Nixon, not even George W., man. So it's like, so you have to keep up without a false optimism, but you have to keep in motion, it seems to me.
Kids in high school kids in Boulder and elsewhere walked out.
That's good. I mean, that shows, I think you're going to see a generation, and that's one of the great things about the Sanders campaign. Millions of young people were politicized, inspired. But I think in response to Trump, and I've seen this in response to George W. and Reagan, that you will see a generation politicized in resistance, but then moving, I think, toward other ways.
Values is a word that keeps coming up over and over again in political discourse. And what, in your mind, would be, are liberal progressive values?
You know, it's I don't want to do a litany, but it's the basics. I mean, it's fairness, solidarity, community, justice, rights, equality, peace. I would like to make peace a word that is not treated as something utopian. We would live better off in peace. So I think all of these words are what matter to me as a progressive.
Other than taking out or renewing a subscription to The Nation, what recommendations would you make?
Well, I would say take out a subscription to The Nation. Come to our site, join us. Come on some of our trips we've been doing. We have run six trips to Cuba now. I thought of Eduardo Galeano with Fidel's passing in Latin America. But I would say stay engaged. If you're a student, you know, think about journalism, think about activism, think about joining a meaningful community, but get engaged and study history and don't get cynical. It's going to be a tough few years.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David.